We've been through a tough couple of years.
What the hell happened?
Pressures are real. The fuel price increases are real.
Women are so deeply aggrieved and angry.
You have to think about this as a father first.
And if that doesn't make you angry, you are not paying attention.
It is his way or the highway.
I know our country can do better.
He was an intimidating bully.
A menacing, controlling wallpaper.
Such marches, even now, are being met with bullets.
We still have so much work to do.
Call the election. Call it now.
What am I doing right now?
Let the people of Australia decide.
Jenny has a way of clarifying things.
Let's make some noise, Australia!
Well, hello and welcome to Broad Talk Election 2022. It's so lovely to be back in this seat. It's been a while. We've had a long, long break, Martin and I, but what a time to come back to talk to you. And thank you so much for joining Broad Talk. As you just heard in that amazing opening theme that Martin put together, it has been a huge couple of years in particular for the women of Australia. We have made noise, we have protested, we have marched, we have rallied, we have written submissions to government, we've written budget submissions, but are women being heard? Well, I've got to say, this election campaign, we're only a week or so into it, and I've got to say it's been pretty underwhelming to me, and I'm really wondering where the voice of women is or women are in this election campaign so far. So to have a chat about this for our first Broad Talk Election 22 series, in this episode I'm joined by a couple of fantastic women who are among the sharpest commentators in Australia at the moment in this space. Jane Caro AM, of course, is a Walkley Award-winning journalist, author, advocate, activist, a prolific author, actually, of about 13 books. She's a speaker and passionate advocate for women's rights, particularly the rights of older women and public education, climate action, etc., etc. And Jane, of course, is now running for the Senate in New South Wales for the Reason Australia Party, and I'm going to ask her the reason for that in just a moment. We're also joined by Georgina Dent. Now, Georgie also is an award-winning journalist, contributing editor of Women's Agenda, speaker and author. You've no doubt seen Georgie. She makes regular appearances on The Drum, The Project, Q&A, Today Show, as does Jane, mind you. Georgie's also author of a fabulous memoir, Breaking Badly. She's originally a lawyer and now executive director of The Parenthood. Hi, Georgie. Hi, Jane. It's so great to have you on Broad Talk. Welcome.
Thank you.
Lovely to be here.
We've been having quite a chat before we started, everyone. I just want to just let you know that we've all been talking 100 miles to the minute. And isn't that so typical? When you say welcome, everyone goes really quiet. Jane, look, I've got to jump in straight away. You know, I suspect most people listening to this podcast know Jane Caro, but it was a bit of a surprise to see that you were joining the Reason Party and running for the Senate as an independent candidate or a candidate with the Reason Party. Why are you doing it?
Well, I suppose part of the first reason, to coin a phrase, is because Reason asked me. They rang me up and said, would I consider being their candidate in the next election for the New South Wales Senate?
Yeah, but I'm sure you get asked to do lots of things, Jane. You don't say yes to everything.
I say yes surely to a lot of things. I've never been asked to do that before. And so one of my philosophies in life is the more left field the request, the more seriously you should take it, because that's where you end up doing things that you've never, you know, you would never do. It takes you into whole new places. And also I was feeling, like I think a lot of people, very depressed about the direction that this country's heading in. So I had a good look at the Reason Party and I liked what I saw. It's Fiona Patten, of course, who's a very effective legislator in Victoria's upper house and has been for 7 years, joining with Voluntary Euthanasia Party to really push for reasonable, secular, evidence-based policymaking, which aims to minimise harm, reduce suffering and enhance people's lives informed by experts, not ideology or any kind of belief. Well, gosh, that's a radical idea, isn't it? Why not do that? So I liked I liked their policies and I thought, well, this is something I've never thought about, you know, seriously thought about doing before. I'll give it, I will do it. I will throw my hat in the ring. I want to try.
I reckon it's a very gutsy thing to do because, I mean, the chances of getting up when you're a minor party like the Reason Party up against the multi-millions of dollars that are thrown an election campaign, the chances of getting up are really quite slim. And yet it takes enormous energy and it also takes enormous dedication. So good on you for having a go. It's
Thank you. And I always
– impressive.
I keep saying to people – if the only things you ever tried to do were easy and you were sure you were going to win, you would not do very much. It's the hard things that are worth doing.
Yeah. Jane, I really admire you for doing that. And I love what you just said then about, you know, the more radical the request, the more it's really going to stretch you, because I think that's really, really true. Georgie, have you ever been asked to join a political party or even to run for Parliament?
I've never been asked to join a political party. I have been sounded out about my level of interest in potentially running as an independent candidate. But at the moment, I mean, it's interesting reflecting on Jane's decision to run this time because, you know, in lots of ways, the May 2019 federal election feels like it was a different world. Mm. You know, it was only almost 3 years ago, but it was before the pandemic. It was before the Black Summer bushfires. It was before these horrific floods. It feels like a completely different world. And funnily enough, you know, in May 2019, I had just had Breaking Badly, my memoir, which is my first and only book so far, had just been published. I was still working as a journalist. I was, you know, a contributor at Women's Agenda, but I was very much, I wasn't in a formal advocacy role. It was in June 2020 that I stepped into running The Parenthood, which is a not-for-profit advocacy organisation. I had been on the board as a volunteer for 12 months before that. But really what led me to accepting the invitation to run the organisation was that I had spent a decade writing and talking about the sorts of issues that I know we need to address. And, you know, they align very strongly with, you know, the Parenthood has got a couple of key priorities, key policy priorities, and they are so inextricably linked with gender equity. And, you know, those policies are paid parental leave and access to early childhood education and care. And I think that while I'm not running as a candidate in this election, I am really, really happy that I'm in a sort of constructive formal advocacy role because I think that it does feel different.
Yeah. Look, I think this, for me, and I've been covering elections as a journalist, gosh, dare I say it, since the late 80s, and this election feels different in that the expectation feels different. I think the expectation from women feels different. And yet I'm not seeing the election play out, and as I say, it's only a week into it, but I'm not seeing it play out differently from previous elections. It almost feels like we have snapped back to an old-fashioned media coverage and an old-fashioned media campaign from the major parties. I really am wondering, hang on, what happened to our loud, noisy voices? I mean, why are we sort of down in the gutter talking about elbow and the unemployment figure, whether it's 5.4 or 4 or 3 in front of it, and character, and not talking about the big stuff, but rather focusing on mistakes yet again? I mean, Jane, what do you reckon?
Oh, well, I think because this is the way it's always done, so this is the way the people who get involved in election campaigns do it. This is the problem. This is, if you like, the thick layer of men that Laura Lissy also always talks about, that things just go back to the way they were. And actually they're missing a huge opportunity, of course. 51% of the population, that means probably slightly more voters are women than men, are not hearing about their own lives or any policies aimed at them. The Labor Party's had a couple of announcements pre-election. They've certainly got a slightly better childcare policy than the coalition, and they've talked about getting rid of the cashless debit card, which will disproportionately affect a lot of women, particularly older women, positively. So there's been a little bit of movement. But quite frankly, yes, we're not the main game. We're still not the main game. This is the issue.
It is the issue. Georgie, you're about to say something.
Well, what I was going to say is it is exactly right. That is how it has felt to me watching this week. It seems like, hang on, there doesn't seem to be that fully formed understanding that women do represent slightly more than half the population and women do indeed vote. And what we are seeing that is different is that we have got candidates like Jane who are stepping up, but also we've got some independent candidates who are running in various seats around the country, and the crowds that are turning out for those candidates is pretty extraordinary. If I was one of the major parties at this moment, I would struggle to look at the crowds that candidates like Dr. Monique Ryan or Zoe Daniel or Kylie Tinker or Allegra Spender, if that doesn't send a message to our sort of political mainstream that there is something different this time around, then I don't know if we're going to help. I don't know if we're going to ever get them to budge. But what I would say is I think you would ignore women at your peril at this election.
Well, why aren't they talking more directly to women? Because, yeah, there is no doubt the lineup of women independents and people like you, Jane, and you know, extraordinarily qualified as you are, I mean, it does seem so obvious that the electorate has, in the support for these independents, has acknowledged that we want something better, we want something different, we want a better discourse. And yet the major parties aren't reflecting that at all. I mean, yes, they've got more women in their ranks in terms of candidates and what have you, but they're not talking to them. They're not talking to us.
No, they're not. Well, I think one side doesn't want to. I actually think the coalition keeps thinking, we'll just throw them a few crumbs, you know, we'll give them a few little tidbits. And that'll shut them up. Mm. Oh, they haven't shut up yet? Oh, give them some more tidbits. Oh, my God, they're still rabbiting on. Which has been the attitude of conservative men to feminism for the last 300 years. It hasn't shut us up yet, but they keep trying. Because philosophically,
I think
they don't like it. They don't want women to be the centre of things. You can see it whenever sorry, Virginia.
No, I was just going to say, but to change that, though, you know, we do things like this and we're talking in the margins, but the main game, the mainstream media, and, you know, look, some of my best friends and colleagues, of course, are still working mainstream, including in the press gallery, it seems to be very ready to fall in with what both the main parties are serving up. And not really questioning that, I think. And I'm just hoping that changes. Maybe it's just too early in the campaign at this stage.
But norms are hard to break.
They are. But I also think that it reflects a pretty disappointing appreciation of the structural drivers of inequity and of the sort of injustice that women face. I think that, you know, there's no way around the fact that the last 2 years in Australia have been very different. And yes, partly that's been because of the pandemic, but also the conversation around women's safety in the workplace, in their homes, on streets, it has changed. We are having a different conversation. And I think what's incredibly disappointing is that because this conversation has been happening, there are so many advocates and experts and economists and leaders like Jane and, you know, across the board who are saying women are not accidentally less equal. They're not accidentally less safe than men are. And if we are not going to tackle the systemic drivers that make women less equal and less safe, none of that story will not change. And I think that if the major parties and if the mainstream media are not going to talk about some of the structural substantive solutions that women in this country deserve, then that is why you're going to see women like us coming together, advocates working across different lines to pursue policies. And I think that's why we do have a number of independents who are running. It's not a coincidence to my mind that so many of the independents are professional working women who have lived this life. Yeah. Now, I would also say you have to step back and acknowledge that so many, almost all of the independent candidates who are running are middle class and Anglo. And that is not their fault or their making, but again, it reinforces the fact that power is far less attainable for women, and it is so much less attainable again for women of color and for women with disability. There are so many layers there that make it less equal. And we have to talk about those things. And if we don't pursue the policies, the evidence-based policies that we know would give women the ability to earn an income, the ability to even dream of retiring with something in their superannuation. It's not good enough.
I mean, super, of course, is a huge one. And I know, Jane, you've been focused on not only the rights of older women but issues such as super as well. Yeah. Why or how can we move or shove that issue to the forefront during this campaign has been a point of discussion?
There is one thing that will shove it to the forefront, and that is if some of those independents win office in the election. There is one thing that will shove all of women's issues to the forefront, and that is if women vote for the candidates that are expressing their interest in changing, as Georgie puts it, the systemic barriers that stand in our way. If women don't do that, if women don't vote in their own interests in sufficient numbers, we will basically have said to the men at the top, it's all right, you can keep going the way you are, it's just a small group, they don't matter. In the same way as we have people, I believe the number one issue at the moment in all the polls and things about what do people care about is integrity and a federal ICAC. That's what everyone's really concerned about. And that's great, I'm really pleased with that. Except, again, if we vote for this government to be returned, after all the rorts and the pork barrelling and the scandals and the ministers having to leave for this reason and that reason and being in the cabinet but sort of not in the cabinet and all the, you know, absolute money going to mates, jobs going to mates, all the stuff that's been revealed. And if we vote them back in, what we have said is we don't really care about integrity. We don't really care about a federal ICAC, not really. And we're giving government's permission, not just this one, but every government that comes after, to do these things some more. And that's why this election is pivotal. It's pivotal for women's rights, absolutely. But it's also pivotal for things like the health of our democracy and the fairness of our institutions and the transparency of what we're doing. And the really hard thing to grasp is this is about Australians making good decisions about their future. And our fear has to be, given what happened in 2019, that not necessarily enough of them will. And that will send a message that perhaps they don't intend to send. I certainly hope they don't intend to send it. But it goes to that kind of apathy and lack of understanding about how our political system works, which aids the powerful.
Georgie, I know you're jumping to get in there.
Look, one of the things I wanted to, you know, I was thinking about this when you were talking, Jane, is that, you know, we like to pretend that things exist in discrete boxes and that they sort of, that they're not all interconnected. And one of the things, so, you know, this week, unsurprisingly, because, you know, it's a federal election, there's lots of hard hats being worn, there's lots of high-vis, there's a lot of talk about job creation. Now, what to me sort of typifies where I feel like the evidence is being ignored is that I did not hear the Treasurer in his pitch talking about jobs and creating economic security. I did not hear early childhood education and care mentioned. And we know that the biggest, the most powerful lever we could pull if we are interested in creating jobs and unlocking productivity, it is making early childhood education and care radically more affordable and secure. Now, we could generate 255,000 full-time jobs if we invested in making early childhood education and care free, and we would unlock the equivalent of 850,000 full-time workers. Now, that's before you even look at how it would improve the lives of children, how it would improve the lives of women who would then have some capacity to enjoy the dignity of a job, which is language that our politicians are using. And to me, the fact that the questions are not being asked or that it's not in the frame of reference says to me women are not being considered, and neither are children, and neither are families.
We're going to take a really short break. We'll come back, Jane, but I'll take a short break. But then I want to come back and talk a little bit more about the responsibility of those women who are currently in power, in government, in opposition, and why they're not pushing these issues a little bit harder. But just now we'll take a quick break. Okay, welcome back. We've been talking about the issues that aren't being pushed to the forefront of this election campaign, and of course the position of women, childcare, the call for universal childcare, I think is something that I know I've been banging on about, not just for the last few years but for a decade or so. But what is interesting in this discussion broadly in Australia right now during the election campaign is that there are a lot of women who are running, there are a lot of women in government and certainly in opposition, who seem to not want to talk specifically about women, women's vote, women's issues, childcare. Is this because they don't? We've still got politicians who are really concerned about a gender tag.
Yes. I mean, this is the tragedy. The tragedy is that we know that all the facts and figures are on our side. I mean, Georgie is completely right about early childhood education and how important it is, not just, of course, for women and their ability to access the dignity of a job, as Georgie says, but it's also incredibly important for children, particularly disadvantaged children, who benefit enormously if they can access really top-notch professional care. So we're cutting off our nose to spite our face, but I think we have to name it to some extent. There are still considerable numbers of people. Our Prime Minister said it early on. I think his first International Women's Day as Prime Minister, when he said, oh, yes, he was all for women rising as long as it wasn't at the expense of anyone else, which obviously meant men. Mm. So there is still this idea that economic security, that our economy, if you like, is a zero-sum game, that there's scarcity. Mm. And therefore, you know, each of us have to fight really hard to get our bit and we have to hang on to it because otherwise we'll slip down the bottom of the pile, which is the essential neoliberal belief about how society is organised. And women are seen by some people as a threat. And so they actively work. It suits them. There's a benefit. If you want to know why a behaviour persists, follow the benefit. Who's benefiting? Mm. Well, men think they are because they think they're keeping the power in their hands.
What about the women, though, that are in positions of power? I mean, why, and particularly those women in government, why aren't they speaking up? I mean, they're spending a bit of time, in fact, quite a lot of time of recent weeks, talking about the mean girls in the opposition after the tragic death of Senator Kitchens, and tagging people like Penny Wong, Katie Gallagher, Christina Keneally as the so-called mean girls. They gave a lot of press to that. Mm. But why aren't they speaking up about these issues?
Because they survive by pleasing the blokes.
I also think that it points to how readily we want to jump on a quick fix and a little distraction. And let's talk about that. And, you know, let's talk about, you know, there is, I think, an unwillingness to sort of look at these issues properly and actually examine what is going on. And that's sort of what I was saying before about this idea that we can put different issues in different boxes. And I think that the first week of the election campaign, it has been very sort of job creation focused. It has been very, as we all observed at the beginning, it hasn't felt like women and issues pertaining to women have been front and center. And I think that part of the reason that happens is because people just want to put women into a special interest group over here. They don't want to actually talk about the fact that if we were serious about our future prosperity and about economic growth, then ignoring the caring professions and vocations, ignoring the sort of structural drivers of inequity, that it's actually terrible policy. Hmm. And talking about things like mean girl cliques, instead of actually thinking, why have we got so much sexism and misogyny internalized and embedded in our institutions? And that is because we have got the status quo entrenched constantly, and that is men are far more powerful than women are. Mm-hmm. And I think that's reflected in the conversation that we're having, and it's incredibly disappointing. And again, it comes down to we've got the information, and every single person who is interested in the outcome of this election, it is beholden on all of us to have the conversations, to ask the questions. So I don't think it is appropriate that we're not having. I would really like both Anthony Albanese and Scott Morrison, both Jim Chalmers and Josh Frydenberg, to be interrogated about the role that early childhood education and care can play in our economy and in job creation. I just think it's ludicrous that that question isn't being asked.
And it's not just about that. It's if you get childcare sorted and so women can work and accumulate more money, you will get it. That carries through for the whole of their life, so that we also do something really structural and important about preventing the increasing vulnerability of women to poverty in their old age. Mm. But I think something really fundamental is going on. And this is why I think there's this stubborn resistance to what is sensible, what is reasonable, and, you know, bleedingly bloody obvious if you think about it. And that is, to actually seriously look at these things would be to say we are moving into a new period in history and a new world. Mm. Because if women become fully equal and full participants in this society is radically changed forever. This terrifies us who do not.
Well, it is terrifying because what you're saying is, and I've just started saying this publicly myself for the first time, although I've kept a lid on it for so long, it does mean that men will lose out. Some men will lose out. Some men will have to get out of the way. Some men will not retain the positions of power that they have assumed they are entitled to as women rise and as women rise. But it is, I've dubbed this the century of women, and I really believe that to be the case, and that at the end of this century, I won't be around to see it, and probably I'm not sure if either of you will, but I won't be around to see it, but it will be a very, very different landscape. And I think that, you know, women in terms of power and leadership and control will be in a very different position. But, you know, I think in Australia it worries me that we have this latent, it's not just sexism and misogyny, but belief that the fundamental role of women is parenthood, is motherhood, and family comes before everything. Now, we have that belief, but as you've just pointed out eloquently, both of you, and particularly Georgie, and what you're doing in your own work, the contradiction is if we believed that also women are enriched by holding roles or holding down good jobs, et cetera, if they want to. We should be talking about it more, but we don't. But I find myself going back to that very early Howard move in the late 90s when he really pushed back against the Office for Women and defunded it and rolled back a lot of support for women and increased entitlements for women to stay at home and basically breed. That the thinking behind that, the ideology behind that, which is that women are here to be homemakers, I find really quite terrifying that that is really what's behind this conservatism right now, and that women in government are playing into it.
And it's religiously based. There's a lot of religion behind this as well. This is this idea of complementarity, where men and women have rigidly policed different roles, and that God has ordained this, and therefore, so there's a whole lot of ancient ingrained stuff which it's really hard to kind of dismantle, and that's why this fight has been going on for so long. What's wonderful, and this is really hopeful, I think, and it is symbolised by, as Georgie was talking about, the rise of the independents and the sorts of crowds they're drawing, is that women have gotten in touch with their anger for the first time as a result of #MeToo in 2017. And that is beginning to change the world, because we were never allowed to show our anger or act on it previously to that. And now we're all so kind of energized by it, because that's the great thing about anger versus depression. It's energizing, and we move outwards. So I still have a lot of hope that we may give the blokes a big fat surprise come 2021.
Well, look, there's a couple of things there. I think that there's also no doubt, and this is obviously quite inextricably linked with the Me Too hashtag, but the role of social media in enabling women to mobilize and organize and sort of act collectively has absolutely changed things for women over the last decade. But to your point, Virginia, about the sort of expectations around women's roles, I think you're absolutely right. We are very, very wedded to men as breadwinners, women as caregivers. And we are wedded to those roles in a sort of far more pronounced fashion than in other countries.
Yeah.
And again, I would say that's not accidental. That is a reflection of the policies that we have, because we are all a product of, you know, none of us exists in a vacuum. We grow up in families, we're parts of communities, we go to schools, we're parts of workplaces, sporting clubs. The culture in all of those environments is informed by the policies that we have. All of the policies that we've got in Australia perpetuate the idea that men should earn money and women should care for children. And one of the things that really irks me about that is that there are lots of people who would say the reason they would love for women to stay at home with their children is because that is best for children. And what really, really irks me, and Jane can obviously talk to this in the older years, but in 2020, UNICEF ranked Australia 32nd out of the 41 richest countries on child wellbeing. They specifically called out the fact that we are failing to deliver consistently good outcomes, health, educational and social outcomes for children. We have got at least one in five children arriving at school developmentally vulnerable. Now, for First Nations children, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children, it's at least two in five. For children who live in rural and remote areas, it's at least two in five. Now, when a child arrives at school behind, they rarely, if ever, catch up. We embed disadvantage that they carry with them over the course of their lives. And we know that even 1 year of quality early education and care in the year before a child starts school halves the chance of them being developmentally vulnerable. So if you care about children, and if you want to say that we're a country that cares about families, then it does not gel with what we're doing right now, because what we are doing right now means we are relegating 20% of children to lifelong disadvantage. And we're also overlooking the fact that children do best when their parents are supported. Children actually do far better when they've got engaged fathers. So this idea that all a child needs is to be at home with mum to thrive is so far from the evidence base, but it's also not realistic, because a mother who is home with children does not necessarily have access to financial means, and children don't do very well when they live in poverty, surprise, surprise. Mm. Children don't do very well when their mums are trapped in abusive homes, abusive relationships. So I think that this is where we sort of, you know, the hard yards that we have to do are we have to fight for structural reform to change the story for women. As Jane said, change the story, change the trajectory of a woman's life. Instead of accumulating poverty over the course of her working life, accumulate retirement savings.
Mm.
Set children up to thrive.
Look, I couldn't disagree with anything that you have said, Georgie, but I do find myself thinking, but haven't we been saying this? Haven't we been acting on this as women of Australia have ever, as I said at the beginning, have marched, have rallied, have written, have submitted, et cetera, et cetera. And the fact that here we are in the first week in an election campaign, a critical election, and none of these issues are getting any oxygen or any air at all, haven't we failed?
I would say these issues are getting some oxygen in among women. They might not be getting.
Yeah, I would say like on the margin. So, Jane, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say I think we have to face the fact that it's back to what you said, Virginia, about the fear that men have that if they give space to women, they will lose out. Therefore, one of the ways to persuade women to take a sort of secondary role is to say to them, oh, your children will suffer if you don't stay at home and look after them. So you guilt women into feeling like they do need to do this because it helps the children. But as you say, Georgie, all the evidence says that that is actually not true. It's not, it just doesn't, the facts don't stack up. So when people ignore the facts, you have to recognize that the facts are a rationalization for something else. And I think what we have is a society that at bottom is all about not protecting children, not protecting women, protecting men. Because you just think about the fact that we had that spate in Sydney of king hits, you know, the king hitting where and it was terrible, and a number of young men died as a result of these random, bizarre attacks. And we actually closed the whole city down at night, you know. Bars weren't allowed to open beyond a certain time. I mean, my goodness. Look, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have taken action. I don't know if that was the right action, but good. I'm glad we took action against
violence. But, we're talking about women and violence and attacks and the fact that women aren't safe in our own streets, and yet
and
we can talk about it as if it's a bit of a shrug issue. Like, oh, yeah, well, we know that.
Almost one woman a week is killed by her intimate partner, and we go, let's run an advertising campaign about respect, shall we? Would that be good? I think as I get older, I just come to the conclusion that what we're looking at is really a radical rethinking of how we run our society. And it isn't, I've changed from smash the patriarchy actually to smash the hierarchy. So that what's happening, and it's happened in media with the splintering of mainstream media and, you know, social media taking over so much of the function of it before, it's starting to happen in energy because renewables, of course, smash the hierarchy of the big engine energy companies owning all the resources and, you know, selling it for ridiculous amounts of money and a small group of mostly men getting very, very wealthy. That's getting smashed by renewables. The sun and wind just doesn't work that way. It's also what we're doing with feminism. We're trying to smash the hierarchy so that women, people of colour, people with disabilities, you know, all sorts of different people, more diverse people, can have access to more of the power, which does inevitably mean that those who currently hold most of it are going to have to give some up. And that's what we're fighting. That's what we're fighting.
Mm. Oh, Jane, you've put that very well, very, very well. We're going to have to wind up in a moment. But, Georgie, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say that, you know, you noted before, Virginia, about some of the sort of changes that were rolled back by John Howard. And, you know, I was reflecting on, so Wendy McCarthy is the patron of the parenthood, and we talk quite a bit. And, you know, one of the observations that she's made is that there is a feeling right now that reminds her of sort of 1975. When, you know, because Australia actually was, it's hard to think about now, but we were a world leader in some regards when it came to gender equity in terms of having a women's office in terms of the Sex Discrimination Act. And if you go back and look at the debate that happened in Parliament around that, it was a substantive conversation about the issues.
Yeah.
And what I want to say is I think that there is hope that we can recreate that. So, yes, we've had a lull, I think, for the last decade where we haven't had the substantive discussions that actually everybody in this country, it's not just women, but everyone in this country needs us to have about how we can be an equitable, fair, sustainable community. And we will be there.
I couldn't agree more in that I began my journalism career, as I said, in the late 80s or mid to late 80s, and the discussions from Parliament, particularly federal Parliament at the time, was so much richer and certainly a lot more equity focused than they are now. It's quite extraordinary. Unfortunately, though, we are going to have to leave it there because I know you both have really, really busy days and have to shoot off to various things. We're going to try and check in with both of you again during this election campaign series because we're only a week into it and already I'm sounding negative, and I promised myself I wouldn't do this, but I do sound a bit negative. But I'm worried. I'm really worried. I'm worried about the level of discussion we're not having. But just really quickly to round it off now, if you were to, I don't want you to put a sum on it or a figure on it, but you both hinted at optimism, or hope, I should say, but Are you optimistic? Are you feeling okay about where we're heading with this campaign? You're both pulling don't know kind of faces.
I would say that I think there is scope to put women front and centre between now and the 21st of May. I mean, I think, for example, why would our two primary leaders not have a substantive debate on these issues, on equity in this country? And if they're not willing to do that, why not? I think that we are entitled to ask that question. And I think the more sort of critical questions we ask ourselves and each other, that's going to help, because I think we need a government after May 21 that's going to prioritise the interests of children, of women and of men in this country, genuinely.
Beautifully put, Jane.
I have hope in the rise of the move of the independents, of the women candidates, of smaller parties, a rise of dissatisfaction. I remember Aidan Ricketts, who wrote the Young Activist Handbook, has a wonderful quote where he says, "Activism is like the immune system. It rises in response to the threat." And so I'm seeing the rise in response to the desire to change nothing, in if anything, to go backwards, which is impossible. You can't go backwards anyway. So that gives me hope and optimism. I really, really, though, want to encourage everyone listening to recognise that our democracy and our progress is a fragile thing. And you can't just sit back and say, oh, I'll just let my vote do it and then it'll all be all right. I'll vote for the right team and you know, that'll make the difference. You have to do more than that this time. If you care about this stuff, you've got to get up and get active. Find the candidate. I don't care if it's me or somebody else. I don't care who it is. Find the candidate that you think most represents what you want to happen and go and volunteer for them. You know, if you've got a bit of extra cash, donate to them, because people who are pushing this stuff, we do not have the access to the kind of wealth and power that the blokes' parties do. That is just the reality of this fight. So all of us have to do what we can. We can't just sit back and hope someone else will do it for us. And if we do that, if women mobilise and get behind the women candidates and the candidates that are saying we need to do something about early childhood education, we need to do something about women's poverty, we need to do something about women's safety, this needs to be taken as seriously as anything else that we're talking about at the moment, except possibly climate change, which changes everything anyway, then get behind them, help them, put your energy into it, and then we will change the world. Without it.
And I know that we have to finish, but I just want to say one thing. And Jane, because I was going to say this earlier, yes, absolutely. Climate change is a challenge we cannot ignore. And the only way we can respond is to look at the evidence and let the evidence guide us. And that is actually what we need from our government across the board. Whatever the policy area is, we need to follow the evidence.
Oh, there's a whole nother discussion in that, though. Fake news, fake evidence, et cetera. Don't even get me started. Look, you've both been so generous with your time and so, so incredibly powerful in your words. Thank you so much. I've actually found it inspiring, really inspiring. And you're right, Jane, we all do need to get out there and help where we can. Help whoever our chosen candidate or our local candidate is and question them about this stuff and help where we can. Gosh, 1 week in, I'm quite nervous about where we're going to be by May 21, but we will check in with both of you again. And in the meantime, can I say, look, not only thank you for joining Broad Talk, but good luck with both your journeys through this campaign. Jane, you as a first time running as an independent, good luck. I'd love to see you in the Senate. That would be very, very exciting. God, I hope you get there.
Vote one, reason Australia above the line.
She had to get that in. But Georgie, good luck with the parenthood as well. And I think you've touched on, well, you've both spoken, you know, very passionately about the need for all of us to raise our voices. The hashtag Women Vote, I think, is something we can all do, add to all our social media, Women Vote, and keep raising these issues and encouraging others to talk. So thank you for joining Broad Talk, and we'll be back again in a week's time with another amazing stellar panel, and we will continue this discussion. If you want to send me a message, do via Twitter or Broad Talk on Facebook or any other way you can find me. I'm a bit sloppy about that these days, but you'll find me. And join us again next week for Broad Talk. In the meantime, keep talking.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.